KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Fratelli e sorelle, buonasera.
Probably just because I'm an advocate for everybody to tap dance, because I just think it's such a great joy. And it brings so much to my life that, you know, I can't imagine somebody not wanting to.
As far as I'm concerned, this is fantastic. All the rest is gravy in terms of how the rover is going to go about looking around this area, because it definitely was all the indications of being a habitable environment at one point in time.
Possibility of life on Mars. We're taking that up. Also, we're going to talk about tap dancing, and we'll learn to tap dance. But we start with the new Pope, Pope Francis. We are joined again by Tiffany Parks, the editor of We're Rome magazine, author of the blog The Pines of Rome. She was in St. Peter's Square yesterday when the Pope was selected. Hello, Tiffany.
Hi there.
Were you excited?
Excited doesn't even begin to describe it. I was, like everyone there, absolutely moved by him, by that Pope. He is extremely humble, it seems. You know, we don't know that much yet. We don't know what his papacy is going to be like, but his speech was so moving to so many people.
What was it like when he gave that speech? What did the crowd sound like? Because it's crowded there.
It was very crowded. I actually arrived before the smoke came out. I wasn't expecting to see white smoke. I don't think most people were. We thought it was going to go on for a while because there were so many top contenders. So when the white smoke came out, and in fact it seemed gray for the first few seconds, but then it came white, everyone cheered and started pushing towards the front. People from around the city, I was told from people who were out in the city, just everyone started running towards St. Peter's Square, literally running. My husband ran for 20 minutes to get from the house to the square. I was up actually very close because I was there earlier. And the moment that, I mean, obviously they cheer all through it, but the moment of the Habemus Papam is such a historic and iconic moment that we've all seen in films and read about in history. So when you witness it yourself, it doesn't even matter what your religion is. It's exciting. Then when they announced the name of the Pope, no one was expecting that Pope either. I mean, I'm sure maybe a few very in-the-know people might have expected it, but he wasn't one of the top, let's say, 10 contenders. But the moment that was really unbelievable was when the Pope himself came out, and he said that word that you guys just played, sera, which is just such a simple thing, good evening. But I said to my husband later, I said, he had me at buonasera, because it was just the way he said it, so simple, so humble, no pretenses, just, you know, just welcoming us. And then also what he did was he asked, I'm sure you've seen, he asked all of the people where to bless him, to ask God to bless him before blessing the crowd. So everybody appreciated this. The people in the city are, you know, very hungry for someone who is going to be more humble, not as, you know, caught up in the pretense of the papacy, the fancy clothes, the fancy shoes, and instead, you know, focus on the people. And it seems like that's happening. So people are definitely very, very receptive to that.
So Tiffany, after it's over and he goes back inside and the Cardinals go back inside and the crowd starts to disperse, what is happening then? What's the buzz right then? What do you remember?
People were cheering. People were dancing. There were people from all over the world. So, of course, there were Argentinians there. From the very beginning, we saw flags from all over the world, so they were particularly excited, obviously. People were cheering. People were praying. And, you know, a lot of people were trying to get out as soon as possible because they didn't want to be crushed. But definitely positive. I think everyone, anybody who goes to St. Peter's Square to see the new Pope is willing and hoping, I think, to be happy to see whoever it is. Nobody goes there to criticize or to not be accepting. So if you go there, you probably already have some kind of predisposition to be excited about whoever it is. But I do think that speech that he gave was very well received. much more so than the ex-pope, Pope Emeritus, which was people said was quite cold.
Well, I like your eyewitness account, Tiffany. I appreciate you taking the time and sharing it with us, that you were there when the white smoke went up. Much appreciated.
Oh, my pleasure. It was an unforgettable moment.
Tiffany Parks is editor of Where Rome magazine. She's author of the blog, The Pines of Rome. She's from the Northwest. She's working there in Rome. She picked up and went to Rome to work and to write. You can read what she's doing at thepinesofrome.blogspot.com. She was in St. Peter's Square yesterday when the Pope was selected. Father Steven Sundberg is president of Seattle University. He is a Jesuit. Father Sundberg, good to talk to you again.
Good morning. Morning, Steve.
I know that you have many emotions, but I want to ask you about one in particular, if I may. What
Sure.
does it mean that a Jesuit ascends to the papacy?
It was such a surprise. There was only one Jesuit in the College of Cardinals. I was on live on a studio commenting on the scene in St. Peter's, and when I heard the name Bergoglio, I wasn't daring enough to say, oh, that's the Jesuit who was chosen. I had to have that confirmed by the staff, because I just could not believe that a Jesuit had been chosen. We just never have thought that there would be a Jesuit pope, for the reason that Jesuits normally do not become bishops. I think there's only one active Jesuit bishop among the 250 in the United States. It's only in special circumstances that Jesuits would agree to become bishops. We try not to become. And therefore, there are very few in the world, and sort of the Jesuits are seen as more the educational priests or the wing of the church. And therefore, it's kind of unusual. Sometimes, because of our educational institutions, we're kind of out in thought about culture and contemporary ideas and politics and globalization and so forth, and therefore are often thought of as sort of a progressive edge of the Catholic Church. And therefore, I thought that there would be more suspicions of the Jesuits than there were in these cardinals choosing a Jesuit as the pope.
Well, these writers around the world are saying this is and him choosing the name Francis, this is a way to step back to the beginning and start again. Do you see it that way?
Well, there's a great tone, isn't there? I mean, people are talking about a new era in the Catholic Church, and I think most of that is in the hopes of people. It's certainly like the lid has been taken off of what people hope that the Catholic Church might develop and become, and they're placing all of these hopes in the fact that this is a pope from Latin America, from Argentina, that identified with the poor, that is humble, and that has chosen Francis. And so we're loading a lot of our personal hopes on, and I don't know whether it's going to be a new era. He's also a traditional person. He's a person that the cardinals chose because he knew there was going to be a strong continuity in the Catholic Church under his leadership, but they deeply trust him. So whether or not it's a new era or not, I don't know. His identification with the poor is probably sort of the fulcrum of what really might be new in him.
It's interesting. It almost seems that there either could be a contradiction in what we're analyzing, or he's, and I don't mean to belittle this, but he's a little bit like Jimmy Carter coming to Washington, D.C. In other words, is he going to be, that's the other question people are asking, is he going to be naive? Will he be rolled by the people who are in power, or will he have a way to reform the church?
Well, there's two things on that, that the sort of the word among Jesuits and talking with Jesuits last night and those that they know that are from Argentina, the word that they've heard is that this is a person who can be tough, and that when he was the head of the Jesuits in Argentina from 73 to 79 under a military dictatorship, he had more than 500 Jesuits. Many of them were sort of feeling the spirits of post-Vatican II, and he had to maintain the order, and he had to be tough on some of them and sort of corralling them and lassoing them and bringing them into a more disciplined kind of way of behavior. And so they look upon him as a tough person. It's also been said, though, as this was back in 2005, give Bergoglio 4 years and he will have taken care of the problem in the Vatican Curia in terms of reorganizing and reforming and breaking up what's kind of an entrenched situation. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know. People say, well, he seems so mild-mannered. Is he up to the job? I think the cardinals have chosen someone they know is tough and is up to the challenges in front of him.
Let me ask you about that question of the Curia. What is the criticism, as you understand it, and more pointedly, do you think it's a valid criticism.
I do think it's a valid criticism. What the criticism is that because of the long term of John Paul II, he really did not have proper oversight of the 10 or dozen administrative units of the Catholic Church from headquarters, where the most important decisions of the Catholic Church are made that affect people's lives, whether on orthodoxy or on liturgy or on marriage tribunals or on sexual abuse or whatever. And that because he was elderly and was frail and was traveling and so forth, he didn't have much oversight of that, and therefore that grew into a little bit too much. They became too powerful and too much autonomous. And then with Pope Benedict XVI, I don't think anyone, and he didn't think of himself as a strong administrator. He was more the scholarly professor, deeply spiritual, quiet kind of pope that himself probably did not seek to really engage himself in that area of the administration in a forthright kind of a manner. So I think what people feel is that, yes, we need to have these administrative units within the Catholic Church, but they need to be under the oversight and they need to be modulated by the pope, and that's a very hard thing to do. Every pope comes in wanting to reform the Curia and to break up its entrenched nature, and no one in recent centuries has been able to do that, and it's a difficult thing to do, and whether he has the mettle to do that and the time to be able to do that, we'll see.
Now, they're entrenched because it's a bureaucracy, and like any bureaucracy, people are able to pass their power to their chosen ones over time?
Yes. Well, each of them is headed by a cardinal, and they're the people that make the decisions that are pertinent to that part of the administration of the Catholic Church, and the less oversight there is of that, they each become more independent of one another. And the recent leak of the butler who leaked the letters and so forth showed a lot of rivalry that was going on between the different heads of the different parts of the Vatican Curia. It's not the most important thing that a pope does or will do. And more important is his central, how do we show our faith through works of justice and the service of the poor. But, I mean, dealing with the administrative issue is an important thing because it has a practical impact on the lives of Catholics in regard to the appointment of bishops, the determinations about orthodoxy, the reining in of various theologians, the determinations about sexual abuse, what our liturgies are like or masses and so forth. So they really are at the reins of the things that touch the lives of ordinary Catholics. And the Pope is more kind of the successor of Peter, who is the one who presents the vision and symbolizes the unity of the Catholic Church. So these are very important administrative units, and it's important that they function properly and in a coordinated and collaborative kind of way with the Pope.
All right, so Father Sundberg, last question here. As you mentioned, Francis does have some history with Argentina and the junta and questions about how he acted and where he was. But even today, he and the Argentinian President Cristina Kirchner have a dispute over some of her permissive policies, as some people put it. What are you looking for going forward in terms of his role as a Jesuit and somebody who is in the world? What are you looking for in terms of actions or policies that tell you what direction we're headed?
What we're going to see is a person who so identifies with the people that he will listen and learn from them, listen deeply to them and learn from them. And therefore, I think his engagement with the issues of the day will be with deep understanding of what people are like and what they're dealing with. I mean, you cannot have had 35 years of identification with the poor and the way in which he has without being on the side of the people. And therefore, that's not going to suddenly stop, and he's going to take that side. And I don't know what that means in terms of changes of positions or doctrines of the church, but I think it'll mean that those will be heard more because people will know that they're better understood by this pope.
Father Sundberg, thanks for taking the time.
Glad to be with you.
Father Stephen Sundberg is president of Seattle University, a Jesuit, talking to us about the choice of Francis as the new pope, Francis I. This is Weekday.
It's 919, KUOW 94.9.
To KUOW, some listen for the reliable, honest, in-depth, international, national, and regional news. Some listen for the open debate of issues, ideas, and events. I'm Steve Inskeep of NPR News. No matter why you listen to KUOW, you have the power to help KUOW, and also, by the way, keep the fund drive short. Just make your gift of support today. Pledge online at kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the City of Seattle, working to stem pollution in the Lower Duwamish Waterway by offering workshops to local residents on preventing oil leaks, proper vehicle maintenance, and natural yard care classes. More information online at seattle.gov by searching Protect Duwamish.
52 degrees in Seattle, expecting a high today in the mid to upper 50s. Clouds, rain likely this afternoon, and breezy conditions. Wind up to 13 miles an hour. Tonight, look for a low in the upper 40s with showers expected.
When psychiatric patients are turned away from mental health facilities due to a lack of beds, they often end up at emergency rooms. In many cases, the ER can't provide adequate mental health treatment, but they do provide a bed. It's a practice known as psychiatric boarding. And according to a recent decision by the Pierce County Superior Court Commissioner, it's unacceptable. The state will challenge that ruling. Yesterday, we spoke with Jane Beyer of DSHS. She says sometimes the mental health system has to turn to the ER rather than turn a person out onto the street. This morning, we're looking at how this is affecting hospital emergency rooms. Is psychiatric boarding a safe practice for patients and staff? Darcy Jaffe is Chief Nursing Officer at Harborview Medical Center. Darcy Jaffe, thanks for talking to us.
Good morning.
Good morning. What problems does psychiatric boarding present for hospital emergency rooms?
Well, you know, different emergency departments have different resources. We have very small emergency departments in rural areas that when a person with a psychiatric emergency is boarding in their emergency department, it becomes a significant crisis. We have larger emergency departments that have different resources and have put resources into this new population, although I have to say boarding's been around for a long time, and in Washington, we've been working on this for well over a decade. The difficulties that we see are that with any patient that comes into an emergency department, the idea is not to have them there for hours and days at a time to take care of them. So if it was a cardiovascular emergency or any other kind of emergency, we would see emergency departments having problems as well. With a psychiatric patient, there is the additional difficulty of an expertise not being available. It's with the facility not being set up safely, patients in some emergency departments are required to be in restraints on stretchers, that being the only way that safe care can be provided until an appropriate bed is found for them. The staff are not, in a lot of places, don't have the expertise and feel very ill-equipped to provide the kind of care that they would like to. The stimulation of an emergency department for someone in a psychiatric emergency is sometimes makes their condition even worse and can be disruptive to their care and to the care of others as well.
Tell me, how long on average does a psychiatric patient who ends up in the ER in psychiatric boarding stay there before they're moved on at Harborview?
Well, again, it can, you know, Harborview's, we do have a psychiatric unit at Harborview, so we have a little more flexibility in our ability to get people up to the beds at Harborview. So the stay can be anywhere from a few hours to sometimes it's a few days.
So yesterday we spoke with Jane Beyer with the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services, and I asked her whether psychiatric boarding was safe.
It is clearly not the most appropriate place to treat patients. Whether it's dangerous, I don't think so. I mean, they are in an emergency department. There are legitimate concerns that the hospitals raise about having these individuals in their emergency departments, especially when you've got nurses who are not psych nurses.
So let me have your response to that. Is it safe overall?
Well, I think that it's safer than the person not being under any kind of medical care. So when someone is put on a psychiatric emergency detention, they're very, very psychiatrically ill. And if the alternative is nothing, then I think that this really is better than that. Is it, and most hospitals will tell you that they struggle with this, but they do provide a safe environment. Is it as safe as if someone was going to be in a, you know, a psychiatric unit? Probably not. Are there times when psychiatric or when emergency departments have troubles? Then I would say probably. At Harborview, we actually have a designated area in our emergency department that's specifically designed for the care of people with psychiatric emergencies, so we're able to provide a safe level of care to the patients and to other patients for the staff. But, you know, but still, an emergency department's not set up for people to be there for long periods of time.
Over time, you mentioned that psychiatric boarding has been going on for a while, this issue. Have you seen the number of psychiatric boarders increase at Harborview or more broadly around the state?
Definitely. We have psychiatric boarders almost every single day. Sometimes we have, you know, upwards of four or five at a time. It used to be that we would have periods of a few weeks here and there where we would have psychiatric boarders, and then we wouldn't have any for months, and then it would happen off and on. So it was it wasn't enough to put into place anything in particular, but over the course of the last few years, it has become, not just for Harborview, but for, I would say there's probably not an emergency department in Washington, and honestly, even across the country, that doesn't struggle with this. Washington's kind of actually late in the game with psychiatric boarders. This is something that has hit other parts of the country much earlier, much more significantly. It's, you know, it's to the point where the Joint Commission, which is an accrediting body for most hospitals, actually has developed standards of care related to psychiatric boarding.
Why did we come later? Did we have in Washington State a more robust system for housing people who needed that housing?
Well, there's a lot of factors. The Washington actually has done a really good job over the years of providing community resources to keep people from getting to the point where they are in a psychiatric emergency that requires hospitalization. A lot of those resources have been dismantled over the last few years due to some of the, you know, the economics of our time and the funding cuts that have happened at the local level for crisis services.
So, Darcy Jaffe, what needs to be done to fix this now?
There's no easy fix. We would have fixed it a long time ago if that was the case. I do think, though, that, you know, there often is a sense that the answer is to fund more state hospital beds. And while it's Washington is so underbedded in per capita that there probably do need to be a few more state hospital beds, but really the answer is more local beds and more so funding for what are called evaluation and treatment facilities, more funding for crisis services so that people don't get to that point. It really is it's something where we have gone so far backwards because of the economic times that it's going to take a lot and a lot of different sorts of initiatives to get us going in the right direction again.
Jane Byer talked about wanting to see just what you had mentioned, more upfront community crisis clinics, I guess is a way to put it, where people could be housed and get treatment in their closer to their community, so closer to before they're at the need of going to Harborview or somewhere.
Right. I think that it's, you know, the further you are away from your local, where you live, the harder it is to get, you know, to get your care stabilized and then go on to that next point of transition.
All right, Darcy Jaffe, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Darcy Jaffe is Chief Nursing Officer at Harborview Medical Center. We're taking a look at the issue of psychiatric boarding, where mental patients, because of the lack of beds at some of our facilities, end up at emergency rooms. This is Weekday. All right, now let's go out of this planet. NASA's rover Curiosity has discovered chemical evidence of life. So what does that mean? The possibility of life on Mars. The chief scientist at the California Institute of Technology went so far as to say that rover found a habitable environment that is so benign and supportive of life that were water there, it would have been drinkable. David Catling is a professor in the Department of Earth and Space Science at the University of Washington. On his webpage, he asks, was there life on Mars? So he is here. I can ask him that. Was there life on Mars?
Maybe. So we don't know yet.
Are we closer to knowing because of this discovery?
I think we're edging closer, yeah. So what it found was the kind of chemicals that can support life, and also that it found more evidence that there's been water on the surface of Mars, liquid water, and that's really crucial. I mean, wherever we find liquid water on the Earth, we find life.
What was that evidence for water?
Well, what they did was they drilled into a rock on another planet, which is actually the first time they've done that. Previously, they've only just scraped at the surface, if you like. And so they drilled in a few centimeters or a couple of inches or so. They pulled out the material and they stuck it into some complicated instruments that determined what that chemistry was. And what they in particular found is that they found about 20 to 30 weight percent of clay minerals. And these are the kind of substances, as you know, you find on the side of riverbanks or you find wherever there's been some water and it's chemically changed rocks and turned them into clays. So we know there was some water around on the surface. And then we also know from the measurements that it has all of the right chemical elements for life. So if we were to measure you, we would find that 99% of you is made up of only a certain types of elements, which I remember with the mnemonic sponge. So that's sulfur, phosphorus, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, and hydrogen. That's 99% of you. And all of those elements are known from these measurements and others to exist on Mars.
So you heard this information coming out. Were you excited? Ho-hum? What were you thinking?
It's always exciting when NASA has a press conference from Curiosity Rover about some major announcement. You know you're going to learn something new. So I was excited to hear that, you know, they finally confirmed these kind of things on the surface of Mars. They had previously, back in September, they found some pebbles and gravel, which was sign of a stream bed, because the location where the rover is sitting right now is sort of at the end of what we can see was a kind of river or a channel that came in to this crater. It's sitting in a crater which is about 100 miles across. And within that crater, there's a huge mountain which it's heading towards, which is about 5 kilometers tall. That's 18,000 feet. So it's bigger than Mount Rainier. And there's a lot of stuff there. I mean, there's some geologists on this mission. Of course, they're very excited about what kind of rocks are going to be there, and it's the rocks and the chemistry that tells us whether potentially there was life there.
So we have the chemical makeup, we have this physical makeup we look at.
Right.
How come you still say possibly and potentially? What's the definitive?
Well, we haven't found life
or even remnants of it.
So Curiosity has the capability to find organic molecules, so those are carbon-containing molecules of the sort that life is made of. And at the moment, it hasn't found definitive molecules that were Martian. What it's found is some molecules that probably were brought from Earth, and trying to decipher the difference between contamination and what's on Mars is a bit tricky.
Brought from Earth by?
In the instruments. So it's very hard to clean all of the instruments perfectly.
I thought they had solved that problem, really.
Well, not entirely. I mean, when you're dealing with tiny, very precise measurements, which are parts per billion level, it's really hard to get rid of everything.
Now, you are an astrobiologist. Yes, can I call you that? You do astrobiology.
Yeah, that's one of the ways I describe myself.
Yeah. I do research under the broad umbrellas of planetary science, geobiology, or astrobiology. The last one, the new branch of science concerned with the origin and evolution of life on Earth and the possible variety of life beyond Earth. So this is your forte. What are you learning just so far towards those larger ideas of where life might be around the universe?
Well, some people listening might wonder, well, supposing we find microbes on Mars, so what? You know, there's plenty of bacteria everywhere. They're in my bathroom, in my kitchen, and so on. But the point is that if we found an independent origin of life on Mars, it would show that, you know, we're not unique. The Earth is not special. And we would have another example just in our own solar system. So when we think about all of these other solar system equivalents, planets around other stars, then it would make it much more probable that there's life around other stars. And if there's simple life, then there's the possibility it may evolve into more complex forms of life. So it's really going back to a question which is hundreds of years old, which is, are we all there is? Are other planets inhabited?
So you write that for the last 3.5 billion years, it's likely that Mars has been cold and dry.
Yeah.
So if there was water on Mars, when was that?
Well, that's a good question. And one of the problems with the Curiosity rover results is that when you look at a rock on Mars, it doesn't have a label on it saying, I'm X, you know, million years old, right? And Curiosity doesn't really have the capability to determine exactly how old the rocks are. So there's a big debate, I think, amongst the people I know on the Curiosity team about exactly how old these rocks are. The lead scientist thinks they're probably before 3 billion years old, and that includes a time when there would have been the flow of liquid water on Mars. It was particularly prevalent about 3.7 billion years ago. And we see signs of that. So we see dried up river valleys with tributaries, and we see signs of a lot of erosion from orbit, which presumably was caused by liquid water.
David Catling is a professor in the Department of Earth and Space Science at the University of Washington. NASA's rover Curiosity has discovered some chemical evidence of life on that planet. David Catling studies these issues. How old is Mars?
It's the same age as the Earth. So the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago.
So there's a tiny window of about, what, a billion years between?
Well, a billion years is a long time, you know. So that's, and in fact, when we look at the Earth, the oldest sedimentary rocks are found in Greenland. And there's some better preserved ones in South Africa and Australia, which are 3.5 billion years old. And in those rocks, certainly the South African ones and Australian ones, we find signs of life. We find chemicals where clearly life has perturbed the system. And we also find visible signs. So you find these mounds, these mineral mounds in Australia, which are 3.5 billion years old, which were formed by microbes, because we see the same kind of mounds today in some modern waters. So life took hold on the Earth within a billion years of the Earth forming. And so if it did it on the Earth, where there was liquid water and the right conditions, you know, why not Mars? That's the kind of thinking.
Yeah. And isn't that why the rovers are going to these different parts of the planet to try to find where the sweet spot might have been if it existed?
Yeah. So Curiosity, you know, before it was targeted this particular area, several different landing sites were discussed, and eventually they narrowed it down to this one. So the way that NASA does this is it has lots of input from the community of scientists, and they basically ask the question, where should we go? And then they spend 2 or 3 years discussing it, and eventually, you know, they have to make a decision. So in this particular case, because there's this big mountain in the middle of this crater, it was thought that that would have lots of layers. Some of those layers may have encapsulated some ancient forms of life. And then at the edge of the crater, you can see this dried up channel that comes in. So it's known that water flowed into this crater. So that's why it was chosen. But maybe there are other places that are even better. We just don't know. I mean, if you go to the Earth, you could land in the Sahara Desert, or you could land in the Amazon rainforest, and the results you would get would be quite different. Now, of course, Mars is not as extreme as that, but there may be many differences over the surface.
Is there an assumption, and is this right or wrong? If there's water, there's life.
Well, if it's pure water, you need more than that, right? You've got to have the nutrients as well. But what we know from these measurements, these latest measurements, is that there were potentially the right kind of nutrients around. And, you know, it's just when we talk about the form of life that we have here on Earth, one thing you can say for sure is that all of the life we know uses liquid water, and there are no exceptions.
So when you look at the, it's not like they landed those rovers and poof, there was evidence. I mean, they are searching hard to find evidence. What does that tell you about what life on Mars might even have been? What is it, very thin? Was it very tenuous? Do we make those assumptions yet?
Well, I don't think anybody's looking for, you know, something the size of elephants or whatever.
I was, sir.
Oh, you were? Okay. Or polar bears. Or,
Martian elephants like John Carter.
I think most people are just hoping for kind of microbial forms of life on Mars that they existed in the past.
And then what do you see going forward as an astrobiologist? So here's Mars. The next likely source have always been touted as one of the moons of Jupiter. What do you want to see as an astrobiologist?
There's a large community that would like to see missions to Europa, which is one of the satellites of Jupiter. And what we know about Europa is that under its icy surface, there's an ocean there. And it's big. It probably has about twice the volume of the Earth's oceans, even though it's quite a, you know, relatively small planet, the moon itself compared to the Earth. So people are interested whether there's life in the European Ocean. The problem is we don't know how deep it is beneath the ice. It's probably at least 25 kilometers, and it may be more. What I would like to see, and this is currently not it's not currently on the table, but people have talked about it, is that there's a moon around Saturn called Enceladus, which is about 500 kilometers across. So it's just slightly bigger than Texas. It wouldn't quite fit into Texas, but which is our yardstick, right?
Yes, sir.
and Enceladus basically has – it spurts stuff out of its south pole, which are particles of ice. And this was discovered a few years ago. It wasn't expected. And there's probably subsurface liquid water on Enceladus beneath its south pole. And in this plume of particles, the Cassini spacecraft – Cassini is an orbiter around Saturn – discovered some organic molecules. So if I was in control of things, I would send a mission to – through the plume – of Enceladus and maybe send it back to Earth or at least do some analysis, because it has energy. The South Pole there is heated. That's why it's got this big plume spurting out to you. And then there's liquid water there. And then apparently there's organic molecules there. So all of these critical things that are almost a textbook list for life. And it's almost as if the solar system is saying, hey, free samples, you know, take one.
Wow.
So we could just fly through that plume and bring it back. And that's something I would like to see, but it hasn't quite got the groundswell amongst the community yet for that kind of mission.
I'm with you. I hope we do that. That sounds great. One thing about being an astrobiologist, right, there is a lot of time that you can spend studying the universe, because there's a lot to study.
That's certainly true.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
David Catling is a professor in the Department of Earth and Space Science at the University of Washington.
KUOW 94.9 News and Information.
You comes from Harper Perennial, publisher of The Prisoner of Heaven by Carlos Ruiz Zafón, a labyrinthine tale of passion and revenge set in Barcelona, reuniting the heroes from The Shadow of the Wind and Angel's Game. Now in paperback.
52 degrees in Seattle, expecting a high today in the mid-50s, clouds, rain likely this afternoon, and wind up to 13 miles an hour. Tonight, look for a low in the upper 40s with showers, and Friday's high in the mid to upper 50s. Showers likely mainly after 11 a.m. on Friday.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For more than three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
Could you live in a 90-square-foot apartment? It's called micro housing, and Seattle City Councilmember Tom Rasmussen has concerns about it. We'll hear from him today at 10:05.
You know, this show, you may notice we do a lot of tap dancing, right? From subject to subject. Tap dancing, it's hard to learn to tap dance, let alone be perfect at it. Katie Sewell, because we do so much tap dancing, she thought maybe she would learn to tap dance. So she met local tap dance teacher Reggie Bardak at her home for a lesson and to fulfill a New Year's resolution as well, right?
Yes, people who listen every day might remember that last year on the air, I promised to take a tap dancing lesson during 2005. And as part of that... 2012. And as part of that, we asked you all for the names of tap teachers that you would most want to hear from on the air. And most of you said Reggie Bardak. So she was nice enough to let me come to her home and teach me to tap dance and also be interviewed at the same time. Now you start by teaching about the balls of your feet. Why did you start at the front first?
Why did I do the balls of the feet? Because first of all, there's two things we're working on here. We're shifting weight,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So much comes back to the speed.
Yeah.
You're gonna wanna know what leg you're on. Because tap dancing, you break down the beat so many different ways and so much more quickly than if you were just doing modern or ballet. That you really have to know where your weight is intuitively. Mm-hmm. But that was good. Good question, because now what we're going to do is get the heels involved.
Yeah. So it's like the same thing as if you were arching in place, but we're just releasing the heels. That's it. Good. So we're going to take a little exercise, and we're going to go.
Try not to move those balls in your feet. Heel. That was good. Single. One, two, three, four. Try not to go anywhere. Enough work. Right, so you want to try?
You know, I think that foot spent a lot of years being the dominant foot. Was that a farcical statement I just made, where one person has a dominant foot over the other foot?
Not at all. A lot of people, their left sides, we say, okay, reverse it, let's go to the left. And instant problems, instant meltdowns. It takes a while, because we tend to work on the side that we're stronger. And so, of course, our poor, neglected other side, which is our weaker side, gets less and less attention, when we should be just getting more and more attention.
So yeah. Since you came from a jazz background, what was the hardest transition to make from that to being a tap dancer, as far as physicality goes?
Oh, first of all, I hadn't a clue. I hadn't a clue what I was getting into. I thought, probably like most everybody, that tap dancing, oh, it looks so much fun. It's so easy. It's so great. Yeah, I want to be a tap dancer. Because you can learn a lot pretty quickly, and then after a while you realize, oh my goodness, you just learn enough to realize how much you don't know, you know, and how complex. And so the biggest thing, to answer your question, is that I started moving, and I thought it was about motion, and it's not about motion. It's about rhythm and the sound. You cannot make as much sound if you're dealing with motion and traveling. So that's the biggest thing, because we think big, and like when I said gross, when we dance grossly and large, and so I had a lot of chutzpah, and I thought, oh, I know how to dance that easy. And I signed up for a lot of advanced classes and put myself right in the front row. And then you realize, like, big mistake, because I didn't know a clue, you know? It's like, then you got to spend your time. You got to do it. It's just like, you can't. You have to. And then you can travel as much as the music and the tempo allows. And, you know, sometimes people say, how fast can you dance, you know? I remember for some reason we were living in India for a period of time, and they have a long history of foot percussion, you know, of katak dancing and lots of other forms. They're very appreciative of audiences, too, but a lot of it is very, 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 very fast. It says, how fast can you dance? I was thinking, what an odd question, because it's not about speed and it's not about the complexity. It's always just about what the rhythm is or the steps. Because then you take a lot of these particular manipulations we're working on, and they become a particular step, but then it becomes how you put all that together. Pickups added extra sounds that you pull it, and you feel. So everybody can learn to do this kind of stuff. It's what you do with it that becomes, you know, exceptional.
What's your style?
What's my style? You know, I'm kind of like a good solid swing dancer. I'm not super speedy, though I tend to be a speedy personality. I found that as I've gotten older, I don't like to dance so fast. I like kind of like a nice middle of the road swing kind of tempo. Mm-hmm. You know, life is fast enough. Things are confusing enough. You know, I used to like a bebop kind of a rhythm too, but not so much anymore. You know.
How do you get people to push through the, you know, if I was incredibly frustrated and discouraged because I can't separate my two legs, which I'm not there, so I'm going to keep trying. But if I was, how do you get people to push past that?
I think it's like anything else. You have to have a respect for the process. You can't expect to know anything right away. You know, that's like me going into the beginning of an advanced class and, whoa, I'm here, you know. Isn't everybody lucky to have me in class, you know? And then that's that humbling thing is you learn something about the form, and it is an art form. And you have to spend time, you have to put your time in. And I used to always ask, I say, how long? Because you always think, how long until you finally get good? It's something, and my teachers always say it. It used to frustrate me. He says, 10 years. 10 years, you know, if you wanted to really get accomplished at something. But you could learn something all the time. And what you did struggle with the day before is like, whoo, piece of cake. Nobody comes to this because they think they're all of a sudden going to have a second career, whatever, wherever it goes and whatever happens in it. It's for the sheer joy and pleasure of it.
And you say that we don't need to have rhythm, but do we need to have some sort of grace or flow?
Yeah, make a thing of what you don't have. I mean, what you do have. You know, find what you do. Everybody has something. And I remember some dancer who was unbelievably angular, but she was such an interesting dancer. You know, and so you use angles. The one thing you do have to have is time. That's it. That's our biggest job as a tap dancer. We're timekeepers. You can't be dancing off the beat. That's just simply not acceptable. But let's work on a basic shim-sham. How's that? Okay? So we're going to take, it's based on brushes. Okay? Let's do a little call and response. I'll go.
Okay.
1, 2, 3. One.
Okay, hang on.
2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
Oh,
single. That was good. That was pretty good. So you see, what I was trying to make you do is to stay that time goes on. So yes, that even if you mess up, you keep going. We don't stop.
Tell me what it feels like to be you.
What does it feel like to be me? Yes. It feels way too confusing. I feel way sorry if anybody was to be me.
More of a rhythm and a joy about your life that people who are sedentary might not have?
You know, I don't know, Katie. I have no way of knowing that because I've always been a mover. I have the metabolism of a hummingbird. And so I tend to be very quick. But, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, you can dance your blues away. You know, you can sing your blues away, you can dance your blues away. It gives you something else to focus on, and also things feel a little differently afterwards.
Why did you decide to teach adults instead of kids?
I like how fabulous it is when adults and grown-ups take on something new. You have lawyers and judges and people who are highly skilled, lived long lives, and then they come into that vulnerable place to learn something new. It's really very special and magical.
Do you have a sense of what drives them to try something new?
You know, everybody is different. You know, if you have some time to hang out before my next class here, you could ask some of them. I think some people always had an image when they were 6 years old of wanting to tap dance and wear sparkles. You know, this is highly accomplished people. But there's something that still lives in us, or there's that magic of the cinema, and there's something that really draws us about rhythm, live in a way and have some sort of expression that we've never had in our lives before. Something on the side of our spirits or our soul that feeds us in a very deep place. You know, and we're allowed to be beginners because we've already been accomplished in our lives as adults in lots of ways. You know, so we get to be foolish for a while.
Okay, we'll just do a quick around the circle. Why not?
Go for it.
Hello, testing. All right, should we start with you?
Sure.
All right, what's your name?
Kay.
All right, Kay, why did you decide to take tap? And how long have you been doing it?
We've been doing it for how long, Joyce? 3 years. 3 years now. We've always loved tap. And when we were 60, we decided it's time.
So it was time because what? You'd wanted to be doing it your entire life?
Well, my friend had a birthday, and she'd always wanted to tap. And so I got her a pair of tap shoes for her birthday, and that was the start.
Oh, that's great. So had you wanted to tap also when you were younger?
Yes, I did. I did. And I used to ride my bicycle 2 miles across town to go to tap classes, but I only went to a few. And it didn't really seem possible as an adult. And then suddenly, you know, time's running out. What do you really want to do? And tap was one of those things.
So you were the one with the lifelong dream. What's your name?
Joyce.
Was it a lifelong dream?
Well, it was kind of a deferred lifelong dream. I took one tap class when I was in kindergarten. The tap teacher terrified me, and before she could get to me to do the shuffle step thing, I went running to my mother, threw myself into her lap, cried, and my mother had to pay for a whole session of tap lessons that I never took. So it's always been a deferred dream. And I think I mentioned it like in a drunken stupor or something to Kay at one point. And then when I turned 60, she bought me tap shoes.
Why do you think you wanted to take tap as a kid?
Because it's noisy. I'm not particularly the fluffy, graceful tutu. Both my sisters took ballet, and I'm not the ballet type.
What did you think when she brought you those tap shoes?
Oh, I was appalled. I was really appalled. Because that's a commitment. Then, you know, you can't just go around saying, oh, I wish I'd taken tap class. Now I had to do it, so. And I did.
So that's a good friend.
Lifelong dream, lifelong friend, yeah.
Very cool. All right. Coming around to you. What's your name?
My name is Becky, and I'm actually Reggie's sister-in-law.
Oh.
So she kind of badgered me for a while. you should learn how to tap, Becky. So one day I said, okay, I'm going to, and I love it. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I have this vision of being on stage, but never will happen.
Never know.
Uh-oh. It'll never happen.
Reggie, why did you want her to do it?
I don't remember badgering her, but then I'm notorious with my memory or lack of memory. Well, probably just because I'm an advocate for everybody to tap dance, because I just think it's such a great joy. And it brings so much to my life that, you know, I can't imagine somebody not wanting to. So I guess that might have been it.
Do you think you're ready for the stage yet?
Oh, no.
How much more time do you need?
Very, very long time.
I'll give you a year. I'll give you a year. All right. Are your sisters doing ballet still?
No. No, they're not. No.
Is tap dancing something that you can do throughout your life more than, say, resting on the tips of your toes?
Absolutely. Because of the ballet dancers, basically you stop when you've had a full career at 35, right?
Can you tell about the chair dance?
Oh, yeah. We've been learning the copacetics chair dance. We have intentions of sitting in chairs and dancing, too, well into our 80s.
That's tap dancing teacher Reggie Bardak and some of her students talking with Katie Sewell. If you're interested in getting in touch with Reggie, you can find her email address on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. Happy dancing.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of an infusion pump sent to us by Weekday listener Sean. He says, to him, this is the sound of cancer. He recorded it yesterday while visiting a friend undergoing cancer treatment at the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. Yesterday, it was his turn to be a patient there. The pump slowly dispenses poison into the body in a controlled fashion, chemo. Sometimes the pump dispenses other things like red blood cells or drugs to help bones regain strength. Sean says this is not only the sound of cancer, it is the sound of patience. It has the power to be soothing, and it has the power to be menacing. And as he sat with his friend, he realized this sound also has the power to heal. Thanks for that sound, Sean. More Weekday ahead. Stay with us.
KUOW 94.9. It's 10 o'clock.
Support for KUO.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.